Thanks for tuning in to the Drive On Podcast, where we talk about issues affecting veterans after they get out of the military. Before we get started, I'd like to ask a favor. If you haven't done so already, please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts. If you've already done that, thank you. These ratings help the show get discovered so it can reach a wider audience. And while you're there, click the subscribe button so that you get notified of new episodes as soon as they come out. If you don't use Apple Podcasts, you can visit driveonpodcast.com/subscribe to find other ways of subscribing, including our email list. I'm your host, Scott DeLuzio, and now let's get on with the show. Hey everyone, today my guest is Dr. Margaret Rutherford, who is a psychologist, the host of the Self-Work podcast, and the author of the book Perfectly Hidden Depression. I'm certain I'm missing a few accolades here. So Dr. Rutherford, welcome to the show. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about yourself, your background, and what you do?
Sure. Thanks, Scott, so much. And oh, there's so many accolades I could barely, you know, I have paparazzi standing outside the window. Well, I actually have a bit of an interesting route to being a psychologist, if you'd like to hear that. I was actually a professional singer in my 20s. I sang jazz and jingles. I sang jazz at night, and then I sang radio and television advertisements. And so I did that for 8 or 9 years. I was not doing well with the lifestyle. Music's a hard business to be in, and it's pretty cutthroat, and you know, the longest contract sometimes is a month in a hotel, and you're supposed to be glad you've got that. So I wasn't doing very well. So I heard about this thing called music therapy, and I took all the money I had in the world and put it down at SMU in Dallas and began that career. And as soon as I finished up my training, I was actually at an internship site, and it was at a psych hospital. And I said, oh no, this is what I want to do. And I'd been in therapy for a long time, and it had really helped me. And so I turned the boat around, and so it was about 9 years before I was at the Fairmont closing down the bar there by the singing and seeing my first patient. So it took almost a decade to do that, but it was well worth the effort. I loved being a musician, but I really, being a therapist is my passion.
Well, that's great. And I always like to hear people's background stories, like how they get to where they are, because it's never a straight path. It's never that, you know, I went to college and I knew exactly what I wanted to do. And I got the degree in that. And I wound up doing that thing for the next, you know, 30 something years or whatever. And
there are those people, but many more now are just kind of going from thing to thing. And I'm certainly a good example of that.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. And it's interesting to hear the different paths that people take.
Yeah. The fun thing about doing the podcast was that I was actually in front of a microphone again. So I was pretty comfortable in front of a microphone. So that was funny.
That's true too. And it sort of merges the two backgrounds there. That's great. Yeah. So I mentioned earlier that you wrote the book titled Perfectly Hidden Depression. Mm-hmm. Now, Perfectly Hidden Depression, that's not just a catchy title, although it certainly is that too, but it's actually something that people suffer from, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Really, Scott, I started thinking about a lot of the people. I was doing a blog post for my normal weekly website blog post thing, and I thought about some people that I had seen throughout the years that when they entered therapy, no one would have called them depressed. I really wouldn't have called them depressed. They came in usually for problems about worry or sleeplessness or fatigue, or perhaps they had an eating disorder that was getting out of control, or they were told at work they needed that they were, you know, overworked or something, and they needed, and they were just, I don't think I am. And or their pastor sent them because, or their spouse said, you need to go because they had a loss that was really acute and they didn't grieve or they didn't know how to grieve. And so these people would come in and they would tell me about their lives. And what I would notice was that when I asked about any kind of trauma or experience of pain, they literally would smile their way through telling me about it. It was as if there was a complete, what's the word I'm looking for? There was such a contrast between what they were talking about content wise. They could have been talking about a rape, or they could have been talking about, you know, military service, or that was difficult, or they could have been talking about, again, the death of a child even. And they just kind of had these either stony faces, or they were sort of smiling, going, yeah, you know, that I handled that. It wasn't all that big a deal. And so, because, you know, that would be weak, and there are lots of people with problems worse than mine. And if I started crying, I'd never stop. And so I don't want to do that. Those kinds of excuses. So I was sitting in my sunroom thinking about those people, and the term perfectly hidden depression came to my mind. And I wrote a post called "The Perfectly Hidden Depressed Person, Are You One?" And it went viral. I was lucky at that point if 50 people read a post, and here this went, thousands of people shared it. And then I was writing for the Huffington Post at the time, and I forgot that I had left my email on the bottom of that post. And the next day I received hundreds of emails saying, this is me, I think you're inside my head, how have you figured this out? So I began researching at that time what exactly was available in the literature and in the research about this connection between perfectionism and depression. I found lots on depression, on perfectionism. For example, Dr. Brené Brown's work is incredibly good and very helpful to many, many people. But I could not find, except in some of the research, but not in popular literature, something that said a perfect looking life can mask what's going on underneath, which is actually full of emotional pain, memories of trauma that has all been suppressed and really rigidly compartmentalized, where people don't even know they're doing that, Scott. They don't even know. This isn't intentionally knowing you're depressed and putting a smile on your face. That's one thing. That's called high functioning depression. This is people who have done this for so long that it's become unconscious, that what started out perhaps as a childhood strategy to emotionally survive some kind of situation they were born into, which we can talk about later, but it's, they don't even realize they're doing it. And so when they accept what I've told, these people have told me, is when they see the term perfectly hidden depression, they go, oh, that's me. Mm-hmm. I've got to read about that. I've got to find out about that, because that jars something in their gut that has been trying to talk to them for a long time.
Now, so we're on the topic of depression here, but I want to just make a quick maybe pit stop over in the land of anxiety. So depression and anxiety are both common diagnoses in mental health, but I want to be clear to the audience here about the difference between the two for anyone who might be listening, who might not know the difference between the two. Would you be able to give a quick overview between the difference between depression and anxiety?
Sure, of course. Well, I like to say to people that I've never seen anybody with severe anxiety that's not depressed about it. But I have seen people with depression who don't have a lot of the classic symptoms of anxiety. They may have some, but they don't have all. Depression, classic depression, is mostly that you have a depressed mood, a down mood, a despondent mood that not only you that either you can see or other people see it in you, and it goes on for a long period of time, as well as the other criteria is you don't enjoy doing what you used to enjoy doing. It's called anhedonia. Now, there are other mental symptoms or cognitive symptoms of depression, more like problems with making decisions or having sort of a sense of fuzzy thinking, like your mind is kind of this swamp that you can't get going. So certainly there are cognitive / mental symptoms of depression, but they don't necessarily look like anxiety. They can, worry being one of them, but anxiety disorders are a whole different category. They are things like, there are several of them. There's obsessive compulsive disorder. There's generalized anxiety disorder, which is literally having a sense of dread and hypervigilance that something horrible is about to happen. You can even visualize it. Not the same as a flashback when something's actually really happened as in PTSD. But people with generalized anxiety disorder are plagued with these thoughts and obsessions about what can happen. Then there's panic disorder, which is you can have panic attacks. You can have these shorter episodes of your heart racing and your palms sweaty and you want to run out of the room. Those are panic attacks. And there's social anxiety. All of it is about, and anxiety disorder are actually the number one mental illness in the United States, and in fact, internationally. There's more people with anxiety than depression. We don't necessarily think of anxious people having suicidal ideation, although they might. They might probably be more worried that someone else they love might die by suicide. Certainly, suicidal ideation is maybe the more severe symptom of depression. Now, that doesn't mean you can't have both. Okay, and in fact, people with bipolar II disorder often have, and people with PTSD often have symptoms of both anxiety and depression.
Okay, that's interesting. I didn't realize that the two necessarily went hand in hand. So they're not necessarily polar opposites. They could be, but in some certain cases, they could be part of the same. Symptoms that people are having. They could have both.
I have performance anxiety. It's a form of social anxiety. And so, sometimes when I get up to speak, I will be very, my legs will shake and I'll, mm-hmm. I'll look like a, I've always wanted to see what I look like because I'm sure I look ridiculous, but at least that's what my shame is telling me. But anyway, and I can be, for a while there in my lifetime, I was depressed about having panic disorder. Because I was so ashamed of it. I'm not now at all. But mm-hmm. back then I was. And so there was depression mixed in with the anxiety.
Interesting. Okay. Well, that's good. And I think that was a good explanation to clear up the difference between the two. And I think, even though that's not necessarily, what your book's about or what we're, necessarily talking about it, I think that's still a good general overview to have. So people who are, maybe experiencing some of those symptoms and don't even realize it could fall back on some of that information. So speaking of your book, let's get back to that and talk a little bit about that. So in your book, you talk about the difference between being a perfectionist and someone who strives for excellence.
Yes. And
that might sound like a subtle difference between the two of those, being a perfectionist and striving for excellence, but there's actually a difference in there, isn't there?
As far as what a perfectly hidden depression is concerned, there's a huge difference.
Yeah.
Striving for excellence means that there is there's a learning curve and you're just trying to do the best you can do. And maybe you even want to do flawlessly. I mean, maybe you have this innate desire to really be the best you can be all the time. And that can have pressure in it. But then if you typically don't succeed or you don't do as well as you possibly can, your world doesn't fall apart. Right. You are disappointed, you may have to grieve, but you can say, well, what did I learn during that? And next thing I'll do, I'll strive for excellence again. People, I don't want to say who have perfectly hidden depression, because that makes it sound like a diagnosis. It's not. It's a syndrome of behaviors that are found together, beliefs and behaviors that are found together. It's called a syndrome. From my perspective, these folks are driven by fear and shame that if they don't do things perfectly, if they don't perfectly meet the expectations of both themselves and especially others, that they cannot tolerate that. That is something they will stay up 48 hours, to make sure that doesn't happen. They're not process oriented, they're goal oriented. And so these are people who literally are completely pressured, and because again, I think it's born from what they're told as children, that they're never going to amount to anything, or they're told that, or they were abused themselves, or which and they say, I've got to find my competence in what I do. All the people with perfectly hidden depression are incredibly accomplishment oriented, meaning if I'm not accomplishing, I'm not valuable.
Okay.
And that's shame based. You can hear that's shame based.
Right. So it's the difference between somebody who is starting something new. Maybe it's they're trying to learn a new skill or start a new job or something like that. And maybe maybe doesn't quite go as well as they planned. And someone who is maybe striving for excellence might have a more realistic expectations of themselves in knowing that, you know, this might take some time to learn, as
great
opposed to
the
perfectionist who, like, if they don't get it like that, like right away, then they might feel like they are a failure, or they're letting someone down, that type of thing. Is that accurate?
Without being too clear. Yeah, that's a great way of putting it, in fact. Wish I had thought of that.
you can use that.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I don't want to get too clinical on your listeners, but there are three different types of perfectionism. One is self-oriented, meaning more striving for excellence. One is other-oriented, where you expect other people to be perfect around you. And the other one is called socially prescribed perfectionism, which is about this pressure to meet these expectations of others. And it's as if you are on a treadmill that's going faster and faster and faster and faster. Because how many times have these people heard from someone, God, we cannot believe that you raised that much money for this organization. We can't wait for you to chair this next year, and it'll be even better.
Right.
Or you're at work and you get something done 2 days ahead of time, and your supervisor says, wow, we're not going to give you that much time again. It's kind of like you get caught in this trap of, I'm not just expected to do well, I'm expected always to do better than my best was last time.
Yeah.
And you buy into that. You don't say, hey, no, that's not going to happen. You buy into that. Where someone with self-oriented perfectionism might say, well, that really is kind of my max. You know, what I was able to give on this project was my max. And so we need to negotiate if you're going to expect more. And someone who would fit into the rubric of perfectly hidden depression would not say that. Until they read my book, of course.
That's a good distinction to make there too. You know, knowing the differences between, you know, how people might react to situations like that, where they under promise and over deliver, in a work setting, for example, and then that just becomes expected as like the baseline, whatever it was delivered, and then can you do a little bit better, and then the next time can you do a little bit better and a little bit better, and then. Like you said, it's like a treadmill that just continuously gets faster and faster and faster.
Well, and you see that since it's based on fear and shame, it's as if they absorb the sense of, if I get told that it could be better, that I must meet that expectation, because then I wouldn't be being perfect. You know, it's interesting to me, as I've talked with more and more people doing these interviews, and then people have written to me, they say things like, I never thought of myself as a perfectionist because I never do anything perfectly. Meaning they thought, I think there are people out there who really do things perfectly, and they don't. None of us do things perfectly.
May get lucky once or twice, but.
Yeah, but you know, even then, it's still someone else's perception of what perfect is.
That's true too, yeah.
And so I can't control, you know, what someone thinks about this podcast, or, you know, what I might say to them in session or whatever. I'm not in control of that. So, but people who identify with perfectly hidden depression, they don't even give themselves credit for what they do well. They've just got to keep proving themselves over and over and over. Right.
So, a lot of times, switching gears just a little bit here, a lot of times, especially with people who have been in the military, we tend to detach from our emotions.
Yeah.
I've seen it both ways. Where everything bothers people, or the opposite, where nothing bothers them. Almost like they're completely shut off all emotions.
Yes.
And you talk a bit about the latter in your book, where people are detached from their emotions. What causes that type of behavior?
Sure. Well, again, as you and I talked about, and you were kind enough to invite me on this podcast, I don't work with veterans very much. I have worked with a handful of them. And so I'm not as aware as maybe other people are of the exact whys of that. But certainly the trauma literature will tell you that someone's response to trauma is based mostly on two factors, which is the intensity of the trauma, and then whether or not they've had mental health issues in the past. Now I know, I'm very well aware, I have worked with first responders, and so I'm very well aware that their training is, and I'm sure it's the same in the military, or relatively sure, that that the training is you run toward, you know, the emergency mm-hmm. situation, you don't run away from it. And correct. So you have to detach from your emotions. However, it's interesting that in Dr. Brené Brown's workshop, that she has a new Netflix, it's not new anymore, Netflix show. And one of her tenets is that in order to get to courage, you have to go through vulnerability. And there was a guy who stood up who'd done 3 rounds of service in Afghanistan. And he still had his uniform on, and he stood up and he said, you know, you're right. He goes, people don't want to admit that, but every time I went back into the service and did another Afghanistan trip, I had to work through my vulnerability and my fear all over again in order to handle it at all well. And so, you know, I think what makes people early on, if it's not about training, you detach from your emotions because you, there are many ways, many things. Maybe you were reared in a family where it wasn't allowed. I can remember my uncle, who was a West Point graduate, none of his children, my cousins, were not allowed to speak any in anger or in sadness. It just wasn't done around his house. And whereas, you know, my parents didn't advocate for it necessarily, but if it happened, it was more acceptable. Okay. And so, but a lot of people grow up in families, whether it's military families or not, where, you know, buck up or, you know, whatever, you know, that's not manly or you know, only babies cry. How many mm-hmm. times have I heard that? So there could be that. It could be that you were abused, as I said a few minutes ago, that you were told you never amount to anything. And so you have to shut off those feelings of being hurt as a child and come up with some kind of strategy to deal with that. A lot of people decide to be very accomplished at school. Something else is a more unusual situation, perhaps, but perhaps you have a parent that really counts on you for his or her happiness. And so they say, gosh, I get so proud of you when you do X, Y, or Z. And so whether you like it or not, you do X, Y, and Z. So you get into this way of being that my way of getting loved or feeling loved is by not tuning into who I am, but tuning into who somebody else needs me to be. And then I become that person.
And being a people pleaser in that
exactly,
regard.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And so you don't really know why you're doing what you're doing. You're just doing it to be... to feel valuable.
And is that to make yourself feel happy that you're making other people happy? Does that make sense? Is that one of the reasons why someone might do something like that?
It becomes your job, not necessarily one that you asked or that you ever sure. applied for, especially okay. if you're a child. But you can feel, I mean, I've had people say to me, you know, my mother or my dad used to say, I don't know what I'd do without you. And not mean it like in a offhand, you know, I love you so much, but literally, I need you to be who you are because I wouldn't be able to exist if you weren't this way. And you have to, what if, like you say, what if you take over your, I mean, there's a story in the book about a woman who just became a dentist. She didn't like dentistry, but her dad expected her to be a dentist. Right. And her mother had died or something. And so she just went to do that. And so, you know, some of that is family loyalty and some of that is, you don't always get to do what you want to do. I understand all that. At the same time, when you completely cut yourself off from, you know, my life is fine, I don't have any feelings that are I need to explore, then there's something wrong.
Yeah, that's interesting, and there's probably way more to it than you know, just a simple, you know, one sentence kind of answer in terms of why people you know, detach from those emotions. Yeah. And as you mentioned, you know, there are lots of different reasons. It could
be, trauma is a huge one. I mean, right. I'm sure people in the military know, you know, you get traumatized, and which I've you know, one of the hard things about being a therapist is that you do hear a lot of stories that you have to shake your head and think, I cannot believe that really happened, but it does. Right. And it doesn't just happen because of poverty. It doesn't just happen because of where you live or anything about you. It happens all over the board. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it can hurt so much that you have to suppress or compartmentalize those feelings. And some people never get back to connecting with.
We spoke a little bit before we started recording here about removing the stigma of, you know, getting treatment, the mental health treatment that people might need. But they tend to put it off or they just don't go and seek that help because there's a stigma. They don't want to be seen as someone who might be crazy or who is weak or any number of other excuses or reasons. And then going into your book, someone who has perfectly hidden depression might see themselves as being selfish for taking care of their mental health.
Almost certainly.
Yeah, going to therapy or getting treatment, that type of thing. And really, it couldn't be further from the truth that they're selfish or anything like that. And then that stigma against seeking help, just compounds that issue. But a lot of it boils down to just being vulnerable and opening up and being able to, the ability to open up is something that scares us. So why is it that becoming vulnerable is such a big issue to people who might have perfectly hidden depression and the feeling of being selfish, that they're getting the help that they need, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, you just said a phrase that's so important. They're getting the help that they need. One, they have to be someone who knows how to accept help, and they have to believe they need it. Okay. So basically, you know, I did a study, I don't know, this was before I ever started writing the book. I just, one of my very successful blogger friends put a questionnaire on their blog posts on their websites, which was very helpful. I got about 1500 answers from men and 1500 from women about the reasons why they wouldn't go to therapy. And guess what? Ta-da. No huge, you know, surprising results. Men didn't go because they thought they should solve their own problems. And women didn't go because they didn't want anybody to know that they were going to therapy. So, you know, one was ego-based and one was socially based, right? But let me correct a huge assumption that is incorrect. And that is, therapy is only about asking for help. Therapy is about, good therapy, is about consulting with someone who's consulted with a whole lot of people just like you. Hundreds, if not thousands of people. And they have some ideas about how you can think about something or what you can do about it or how other people have felt about it, how other people have worked around an issue or through an issue. And so therapists are a conduit between the people before you that have had a similar, if not exactly the same problem, and your current situation. So now there is strength and power to the therapeutic relationship, because literally there are some people who've never had the experience of sitting in the room with someone and really being listened to, And yes, you can feel vulnerable. You can kind of feel like, oh wait, this person really wants to see all of me. And so that's what takes courage. I always know I have someone who in front of me who struggles with this, because they'll say things like, I bet the other people you see are so much worse off than I am, or I don't know why I'm here, this seems silly, or the only reason I'm here is because my wife told me I need to be here, and I'm only going to come for one session. I've got to go. All right. Okay. All right. And so, you know, vulnerability in and of itself is not about sudden exposure. It's about letting someone in to see what you struggle with, what you think about. And a therapist doesn't come and just rip something off of you. That's not good therapy. You said something about, is it selfish? It is based, you're talking about you, you're right. But I would counter that if you're a happier person, a more fulfilled person, if you figure some things out about your own life and what makes you tick, then you're going to be a better father, you're going to be a better mother, you're going to be a better parent, you're going to be a better friend, you're going to be a better colleague at work, you know, everything will. So you're not just helping yourself, you're helping a lot of people that you love in your world. Now, I've been gratified. You know, as you said, I do a podcast as well, and a lot of people have said to me, because I say at the beginning of the podcast, I'm reaching out to three kinds of people, the people that are already familiar with these kinds of ideas. I'm reaching out to people who've been initially diagnosed with these kinds of ideas and have lots of questions. And I'm reaching out to the people who think they've never darkened the door of a therapist, but they're just curious enough to see what it feels like. I've heard from so many people that say, I'm in that third group. And until I listened to your podcast, I didn't realize that, you know, therapists can be just normal people. You know, I talk about my panic disorder. I talk about my history with anorexia. I talk about, you know, my divorces. It's not like we have some sort of weird, you know, we're not going to walk around with candles and incense and, you know, hold your hand and say, you're going to be okay. We have techniques that we've been trained in and gotten a lot of training in that really can be helpful to people.
Yeah, that's I think a good visualization that, you know, it's not like some some crazy incense magic thing that you're going to be walking into. It's not like some anything like that. It's just you're walking into a room and you're going to sit down and you're going to talk to another person for, you know, whatever, a period of time that you're sitting there and you're just having a conversation the way you and I are having a conversation right now. You know,
at the holidays, people know, because I always have a big glass of Sonic iced tea sitting in front of me that I sip on all day long. I get extra Sonic ice because Sonic ice is to die for, right? And so get extra Sonic ice and I sip on it till it's not tea anymore. It's just water. I've had so many people come in and say, you know, we love it that you just drink Sonic tea. You don't like have herbal tea or you don't have, you know, some kind of, you don't walk in flowing clothes. You know, you cuss, you laugh, you know. Right. It's like, yeah, I do. I'm me as a therapist. I don't kind of take on this aura of soothsayer or.
Sure. Yeah. 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 So it's, you know, you're walking in, you're talking to a regular person and, you know, I've had other mental health professionals on the show before. And, you know, one of the things that we've talked about is that, you might go and start talking to somebody, a therapist and, you know, the first session maybe doesn't go so well. You're not comfortable with it yet, you know, yeah. And the second session, maybe you open up a little bit more, third, maybe, you know, and then it might take 3-4 sessions before you start to get a little bit more comfortable with, with going to therapy. But, you know, if you just go to the one session and then call it quits because you weren't comfortable with it or whatever, you're not really giving it a chance. So I think it's important that people do stick it out, but also recognize that, you know, like any other human interactions, not everybody is going to be the right fit for you. You know, going to be your cup of tea. You know, you might go in and after 4 or 5 sessions, you might just say, you know what, this person is just not clicking with me. They maybe aren't understanding the issues.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I would say, Scott, that a distinction to make is that if you're struggling to open up and be comfortable, that's one thing. If you don't even feel like your therapist is tuned into you or that they're asking you questions that at least make you think or make you give you some hope or say, oh, you know, I think she gives me a sense of confidence. You know, there are plenty of therapists who get into therapy because, you know, it's just they're drawn to the profession. They want to help people, but they don't really know how to connect well with others. You know, they're just like doctors or lawyers or anybody. Right. So, and since we're in a profession where we deal with, as you said before, vulnerability, then that can make it a little hard. But I'm so with you about don't just decide you don't like it. But if you don't like it, if you walk away from the first session thinking, well, that was uncomfortable, then I would go back to the second session and say, I was really uncomfortable in the first session.
Sure.
And I would take a very proactive approach to it. And you can say, I don't know if that's me, or if there's something that, you know, could we head in a different direction in this session? And let me see if I, it might be me, but it also might be that I'm not responding to the way you're approaching this.
Right. Yeah. It's actually kind of funny. Last night, I found out my wife had never watched the show Sopranos, the Sopranos.
Actually, I haven't either.
You haven't either. Okay. So this might be lost on you, but you know, anyone who might be listening.
There's a therapist I've heard the therapist is
there. There is definitely a therapist. And in the very first episode, the initial pilot episode, you know, this tough mobster guy, you know, walks in to the therapist's office and, you know, he's shut off. He's not having anything to do with this and yeah. He doesn't want to do it, but you know, he goes back a couple times throughout the episode and, by the end he's in tears and he's crying and yeah. it's over these ducks that used to live in his swimming pool in his backyard and then they flew away and he felt like he was losing his family of ducks that flew away.
See, it's not just the ducks.
You know, exactly. And they kept digging and they found out what the root cause of all of this was. And, you know, he was all afraid that everyone's going to find out that I'm going to therapy. They're going to think I'm nuts and, you know, and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, he went and you know, it ended up actually helping him. And so if some tough mobster can actually, you know, get some benefit out of it, I think we all can do
That's funny. You know, there was a guy that I treated a couple years ago who actually had identified with Berkeley Hidden Depression. He was a very successful professional here in Northwest Arkansas. And known, I didn't know that he was famous, but he was famous. I didn't know that. Anyway, he really wanted to work on this sense of perfectionism and this persona that he gives out to everybody that he's got it all together and how he can begin to loosen up and have more true enjoyment and fulfillment and freedom and self-awareness and self-acceptance and blah, blah, blah. So anyway, I had given him this assignment he had had a parent die he was an adult, and he had not gotten to say to this parent what he wished he had, and then the parent died. Mm-hmm. And he'd never let himself feel about it. And so I asked him to write about it and write what he wished he'd said and what he wished he'd heard his parent say. And he was doing this exercise in his first class seat on the plane, and he said, not only was it absolutely incredible that I was allowing myself to cry on the plane, but I had your book open and people could see if they wanted to that I was reading a book on depression. He said that was two minor miracles all at the same time. He said I didn't cry a lot, I let one tear slip down my cheek. Right. But he was just kind of going, wow. You know, and so you're right. People can make, I've had all kinds of people. I've had people who work on oil rigs. I've had people who are first responders. I've had farmers. I've had, you know, everybody in the book, you know, as a therapist. In fact, I love being a therapist in Arkansas because you can get such a wide array of patients. So we're getting a little away from Perfectly Hidden Depression, but
no, that's okay. Yeah. It's you know, good to see that there are people from all walks of life that can you know, struggle with this type of stuff. And
sure.
You know, the people who might be listening to this, you know, if you're feeling like, gee, that might be me, you know, you're not alone. You're in good company of you know, like you said, people who work on oil rigs and farmers and first responders and probably everything in between.
Yes, exactly.
You know, every profession in between. There are those people. So going back to the book, you talk about, five steps to healing, that you talk about. Can we dig a little bit into what those steps are,
sure.
and how that relates?
Well, I have to tell you a funny story again. The publisher who actually ended up buying the books, contacted me about 2 weeks before my final book proposal was supposed to go in to them and they would make a decision. They said, well, we've decided you can't just describe the problem. You have to come up with a treatment strategy for it. And you have 2 weeks. And I thought, oh.
No pressure, right?
No pressure. Gosh, that's like more than half the book in 2 weeks. Okay. So, you know, I had thought about doing that, but not in such a formal form. So I actually sat down, Scott, and I just said, okay, what are the 5 things I really do with everybody? 5 stages of what I think has to happen for someone to decide they want to change in a certain direction. Okay, because therapy is about change.
Yeah.
All right. First thing they have to do is recognize a problem as a problem. You know, if you have bipolar disorder, or you have depression, or you have perfectionism, or you have shame, or you have whatever, if you don't think it's a problem, then and are aware of the impact it's beginning to have on your life, then you won't do anything about it. So consciousness is the first stage. Okay, you have to become conscious of something that can take some mindfulness, some awareness, that kind of thing. The second thing is commitment. There are all kinds of things that get in their way of committing and to the work itself. That can be anything from, well, I don't know what that's going to do to my work life, or how will that change my relationship? Or a perfectionist will sometimes say, well, I tried your exercise and it was too hard. And I say, well, what was the exercise you tried? Well, you told me to pick something small and then and do it in an inferior manner, which is something I tell people to do. And I said, so what'd you choose? Well, this work project I have. I tried to one day do it in an inferior fashion. I couldn't do it. I said, you chose something too big. You chose something too hard. Guess what? They're perfectionists. Right. So, you know, you can sabotage yourself. You can do all kinds of things that get in your way of really committing to the process. And frankly, you can just be afraid. Familiar pain is so much, it's so much easier to stick with something that's maybe painful, but it's familiar, than to trade that in for unfamiliar pain. Okay. The third is confrontation. And what I mean by this is a very cognitive behavioral kind of schema. And cognitive behavioral folks believe that if you change what you think, you'll change the way you feel. And so there's a whole section of the book on what are the rules you're following? What are the shoulds, ought, musts, have to's, cannot not do? You know, whatever it is that is ruling your life, and which one of those do you actually think is helpful to you? Mm-hmm. And what you want to keep and that is valuable, and which is not anymore. In fact, there are old rules that you have brought with you from childhood, like I cannot voice my anger. You know, I can never let anybody know that I'm scared. I can never let anybody know that I'm confused. I've always got to have, there's one woman I worked with who said that she worked from home, and she said in her conversations with her supervisor, she always had to have the answer to the question they were about to ask next. And she was always having to, she couldn't ever look confused, okay? Mm-hmm. Or like she didn't know. A lot of people have that. The fourth one, and then of course, the part of that is you want to challenge those rules and begin to change them, and that's where the issues come. Right. But kind of fun. It's fresh, refreshing at least. The fourth one is connection. And what I mean by that, so it's consciousness, commitment, confrontation, you know, they're all C's. That's marketable, right? And connection. And what connection is this, you have to go back. You don't have to. You can choose to go back with compassion, and that's very important. And look at your life like it is a timeline. And you go back and you say, at age 2, this happened, at age 3, at age 5, at age 8, at age 11, at age 18, at age whatever. And you don't go back to feel sorry for yourself. You go back to acknowledge. Huge difference. You want to go back and acknowledge this. If this happened to anybody, it would affect their life. If you moved to a new school when you were in the 3rd grade and you were bullied horribly, you know, or you were elected school something other, you know, mm-hmm. either one of those, you know, most popular kid or something, either one of those experiences would have changed you, would have altered you in some way.
Right.
So you want to go back and you want to have compassion for that, and you want to see, you know, who you're likely to be in the present because of those things that had happened. And that's a whole chapter in itself. The last one is, guess what? Change. I mean, this whole thing is about change. And I go through all the 10 traits of perfectly hidden depression, and we go through them all. And for example, the one that we've already talked about, where you get your sense of worth through accomplishment, I talk about how you really start to change that is through play. How do you learn how to play again? Okay. You know, maybe you don't know, that kind of thing. So each one of those traits has a direction that you want to change. You want to go toward.
Okay. So that's, you know, so we're talking about, you know, taking that step to go get help and get the treatment that you need. These are some of the steps to healing that will get you to that place, you know, right. Ideally, if you go through those steps and you don't, you don't self-sabotage yourself, you know, in trying to tackle a big project, you know, with, like you were saying before, someone too small,
you know,
or too small. Sure. And it could be too small where it's insignificant and it doesn't really matter. Right. You know, that type of thing. But,
I want to point out that the book is actually more like a workbook, although for some reason the publisher didn't want to call it a workbook. Okay. It has over 60 very specifically designed by me, exercises to help you through this whole process, with lots of understanding and recommendations that if it gets too hard, you may have to find a therapist to work with. Because right. If you've really been traumatized, which many people said, I'm sad to say, have been, then going back and connecting with those emotions can be overwhelming, and you don't want to get overwhelmed.
Yeah, and doing that on your own could be troublesome too, if you're not being guided along with somebody who you know knows what they're doing and what to look out for and that type of thing too.
Right.
So like I said, we went through, you know, taking that first step and getting the help, you know, the steps that you might need to go to. But let's try to wrap up, because we're kind of I don't want to take up all of your day here, you know, on this this episode, but maybe try to wrap up with some maybe healthy coping skills that people can use to deal with life as it comes at us, you know, as things are coming to us. You know, what are some of the things that people could do as it relates to perfectly hidden depression? You know, what are some of those kind of coping skills that people could use?
Well, I talk a lot, Scott, about self-acceptance. That may not seem like a coping skill, but kind of like the soldier who got up and made a comment to Dr. Brown, I think that a lot of times when something's coming at you, and it's not something you expect, it's not something you've planned for, or even if it is sometimes, you know, we may know a tornado is coming, but it's not till we hear its force that we can really understand what's about to happen. But I think that if you know, we all, an ego skill to have is to know what your strengths are, even to be able to write them down. And sadly, some people don't know what their strengths are, and we all have strengths. So you want to be able to identify what your strengths are, but then again, take note of what you know your vulnerabilities are. The skill is involved in, and the self-acceptance is involved in, not allowing either one to define who you are. One doesn't define you. I have a PhD after my name. I'm proud of that. I worked hard for that. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't define me any more than having panic disorder does. You know, they're both facts about me. And if I am ashamed of the panic disorder, then I'll either try to hide it, or I'll be defensive about it, or I'll deny it, or, you know, if I accept it, I don't resign myself to it, but I accept it, then I can work with it and manage it. So when you're facing stress, you want to manage those vulnerabilities at the same time that you count on your strengths. And people who can only see themselves at their strengths don't cut off, again, rigidly suppress anything that they might see as vulnerabilities. And then people who are stuck in their vulnerabilities aren't saying, I do have some skills to handle this. I don't have to cower in the room and be afraid of what's going to happen next. I actually, what's the situation I faced when I was a child that I found my courage? And how can I tap onto what that child knew? Or how can I tap onto the fact that I miscarried or, and I handled it, or I, you know, we all have things that have happened to us that are difficult. And how did you handle that? Sometimes people can say, I just don't know what to do. And yet they really do know what to do. They know, they can identify their strengths. And if they accept their vulnerabilities, then they can manage those while they're looking at the glass half full and realizing, okay, I've got to stay more positive and know that I do have strengths to help me handle this.
Right. And, you know, any of the setbacks that we face in our lives, throughout our lives, even from very, very early childhood, they help us learn and learn how to react to those similar situations in the future. You know, everything, you know, it may seem like a very small thing to, you know, adults who already know this, but, you know, as a young child who puts their hand on a hot stove, they know, they didn't know prior to doing that, that's going to hurt them, but they sure as heck know after they did it, that it's going to hurt them. So they will now go throughout the rest of their lives and not do that again because of that one experience that they had that was a bad experience. But you can also take that, you know, as you're an adult, there, bad things happen all the time to people, and you have these experiences, well, good and bad experiences that you learn from. You know, do more of the stuff that creates a good experience and do less of the stuff that creates a bad experience. And, you know, you tend to, you know, learn and grow from that. But so, but if you're not willing to accept some of those things that have happened to you and you know, your reactions to them and things like that, you're probably not going to grow very much. It's going to be harder to do that.
Yeah.
You know,
I've had people tell me, I mean, I had a lot of people who volunteered to be interviewed about identifying with perfectly hidden depression. I had about between 50 and 60 interviewees who were doing that anonymously. I didn't know who they were. Everything from brain surgeons to there was a motivational speaker to all kinds of people came forward. And most of them said things like, but if I begin trying to disentangle my need to look perfect with this permission to accept vulnerability, then people will reject me because I'm seen as someone who always knows what to do. I'm seen as the person who makes the decisions quickly and efficiently, and I can't give that. I mean, for me to look around and go, you know, guys, I don't really know what to do. Mm-hmm. It's just complete. I would lose all sense of respect and status among my peers. Or if I said, I can't take that on this year, I'm just too busy, then I'm, you know, what does she mean she's too busy? You know, so you have to sort of face this fear of what other people think about you and see you as more vulnerable than you really are. It's just you're setting boundaries. You're setting limits.
Right. So, Dr. Rutherford, I wanted to thank you so much for taking the time to join us today. And like I said, I probably could talk to you all day about this book and this topic. I'd love to go deeper into the book on the podcast, but I also don't want to give it all away. I want people to go out and buy the book and you know, learn about it. If any of this stuff that we talked about seemed to resonate with anyone, go get the book. Like you said, it does read sort of like a workbook where there's exercises and things like that you can go through. But definitely, you know, encourage people to go and seek help from, you know, a professional, who can, help them out if it seems like it's going to be something.
It's available in ebook form. It's available in ebook form as well as just a regular paperback, and it's not expensive. So,
Where can people go to find that book?
Amazon,
I'm sure it's Amazon.
Barnes & Noble. Yeah. You can go to your bookseller and they'll be able to order it for you. They probably don't have it on their shelves necessarily, but you know, they can get it forthwith, as they say. And so,
right. Yeah. And I'm sure a lot of local independent booksellers are probably hurting for business these days with everything going on. So, you know, definitely go out and try to support them once when things start opening back up.
That's right.
So So thank you again for your time. Where can people go to find out more about you and, sure. and your work, your podcast, and things like that?
The website is drmargaretrutherford.com. The podcast, again, is the Self-Work Podcast, and that's on Spotify, iHeartRadio, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, SoundCloud, anywhere you would want to listen to it. Sure. Then I do have an Instagram account that I have a lot of fun with. And anyway, I would love for anybody. Oh, and I do have an email, askdrmargaret@drmargaretrutherford.com.
Wonderful. And so definitely reach out to Dr. Rutherford with any questions that you might have, reach out, to find out more about the book, or just go get the book and read it yourself and find out about it that way. So thank you again for joining us on the show today.
Oh, thank you. Thanks to your listeners.
Thanks.
And for those of you who are in the military, that we really appreciate what you've done for our country. So thank you.
And we appreciate that. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Drive On Podcast. If you want to check out more episodes or learn more about the show, you can visit our website, driveonpodcast.com, or on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Drive On Podcast.